guest. That's a $2,000 tax-deductible charitable contribution that goes directly to WPFW. Go online at WPFW.org. And by the way, you don't have to know when you can come to New York, where Democracy Now! Is based. Just make that call or go online at WPFW.org, make the pledge, and then we'll get in touch with you and work out the details. Maybe you're coming to New York soon, or it won't be for a year. This doesn't expire because we don't want WPFW to expire. Again, go to WPFW.org. And thank you so much.
I'm Muisa Muntali, host of Africa Now, and you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
Welcome to We the People in this hour on WPFW Washington, 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. I'm your host, David Whetstone, and I thank you, the listener, for joining us in this hour. Whether you're a regular listener or a new listener, let me inform you that We the People is a live news magazine that deals with race, history, politics, and culture, particularly where they intersect, and how individuals and groups act upon those very concerns. It benefits us all greatly throughout time, in the present, and for our future. And for that, I'm grateful. I'm particularly grateful to our guests who handle various issues, engage various concerns, and inform us and empower us about various topics. Today, Black History Month and beyond, preserving and teaching about Black life and history, a legacy from Dr. Carter G. Woodson. To do that, we're going to talk to Dr. Kasonya K. Wise Whitehead. Dr. Whitehead is the 30th person and the 8th woman to serve as the president of the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, commonly known as ASALA. She previously served as its national secretary from 2016 to 2021. Dr. Whitehead is also a professor of communication and African and African American studies at Loyola University, Maryland. And at that institution, she's the founding executive director of the Carson Institute for Race, Peace, and Social Justice. Additionally, Dr. Whitehead is the host of the radio show Today with Dr. K on our kindred station of Morgan State University in Baltimore, WEAA. She's also the author of 5 books, including My Mother's Tomorrows, Dispatches from Baltimore's Black Butterfly, Letters to My Black Sons, Raising Boys in a Post-Racial America, and Notes from a Colored Girl, The Civil War Pocket Diaries of Emily Frances Davis. Dr. Whitehead, welcome. Pleasure to have you this morning.
Thank you so much. It's such a delight to be on with you and to be able to have this very important conversation.
Well, we start out with some building blocks, and I often ask my guests not only how they're doing, but I ask them about what they profess, what their vocation is, what their discipline does in the world when they utilize it. If you could just tell us a little bit about your approach to things, particularly since you hold the responsibility of being the president of SALA, but also tell us initially about the Carson Institute for Race, Peace, and Social Justice.
Thank you so much for the question. I like to argue that there are some things we do because it's a calling, and then there are things we do because we really love it, and then there are things we do because we have to, of course, pay our gas and electric bill, and we have to make sure that we are keeping everything moving forward. Teaching is a calling for me, and this is how I maintain my sanity in a world that is constantly shifting and moving, is being able to use the platforms I have to talk about what I think is most important, which is uplifting the history of Black people, not just to America, but to this planet as a whole. I do think that we are the heart and soul of all nations, and we are particularly the heart and soul and foundation of America. I am a professor of communication in African and African-American studies at Loyola University, Maryland. I've been here for 16 years. And I look at that kind of space, that intersection between how we show up in the world with our history, but also how we communicate it, right? Because I know and I believe that the medium is the message. And in order to get the right message through the medium, you have to be able to work both sides. You got to understand the medium, and you have to also be able to come and bring the message. 5 years ago, I launched and founded at Loyola University, Maryland, the Carson Institute for Race, Peace, and Social Justice, which is named after my father, Carson, who was involved in the civil rights movement in Lexington, South Carolina, who was a pastor and is now a bishop. But it was a way of trying to bring recognition to the nameless and faceless foot soldiers who were behind some of the leaders that popularized the civil rights movement, but who were also out doing the work. So within the Institute, which has three centers, a center for public engagement, which is our outward facing center, where we do things like talks around the city. We train young people on how to be backpack journalists. We have our Center for Research and Culture, which is a publication arm of the Institute. We are the only institute in the country that has a publishing house deal where we're actually publishing books through the Institute. And then third, we have our Center for Teaching and Learning, which is where we work with teachers around helping to develop curricula that looks at Black history and the importance of it. I do that as a way of kind of maintaining my research base and maintaining the work that I do. I also host a daily radio show for WEAA, Today with Dr. K, from 3 to 6 p.m., which I argue is kind of the largest classroom in the world, kind of what you're doing here on the radio, making sure that we are using every platform we have to tell the truth about who we are. And then I just took over the reins as of January 1st of 2025 as the new president of the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, ASALA, Dr. Carter G. Woodson's organization, which we consider ourselves to be the keepers and the holders of Black history, to uplift it, to celebrate it, and to proclaim it, that we don't wait for anyone else to proclaim Black history. Based upon the work of our founder as the president of ASALA, I can proclaim it. Black History Month happens, whether or not someone proclaims it, declares it, or celebrates it, we will uplift it.
Excellent. And since we're mentioning ASALA, and we'll often do that in the, within this hour, like yourself, ASALA has been quite prolific in its history and has a high amount of production of educational materials. So I will mention the website, asalh.org, asalh.org. And as we're in Black History Month, Sala is also very, very busy in this particular month. So if you could tell us about some of the engagements it does with the public, I would appreciate that as well.
Thank you so much. So back in 1950, Dr. Carter G. Woodson founded the association. It was a way of bringing together both trained and lay historians. And I say that with a smile. I am a trained historian, but my mom is a lay historian. She can tell you the history of our family and the history of our contributions, which are just as significant and just as important as me pulling out, you know, primary source documents and talking about the contributions that we have made. He did that under this broad banner in Chicago, September 9th, 1915, to be more exact. Dr. Carter G. Woodson was the son of enslaved enslaved parents. He didn't get formal education until he was 19, but he went on to get his PhD from Harvard University, second Black man to get his PhD in history. So the teaching of history was not just something that showed up kind of on the wind of his life, but he actually formalized that in the founding of the association. And then, of course, in 1926, when he realized that people were talking about Black history and celebrating Black history, he began to kind of formalize this moment, sitting right between the birthdays, of course, of Abraham Lincoln, which Black folks were already celebrating. Think about, of course, the impact of the Emancipation Proclamation from January 1st, 1863. And of course, the self-chosen birthday of Frederick Douglass, February 14th. He's like, I'm going to choose my own day. Since I don't know what day I was born, I'm going to declare it. Black folks were already celebrating around these birthdays. And so he founded Negro History Week. And it continued in that vein from 1926. It then went, of course, then became Black History Week. We know in the 1960s, when the term Negro was replaced with the word Black, and I tell people Negro's not a bad word. Go back and listen to speeches from Dr. King. We use the term Negro. And then, of course, in 1966, at this big speech with Kwame Ture, when they were talking about, you know, this notion of like grounded in Blackness. What do you want? People know it. What do you want? Black power. What do you want it now? Say it loud. I'm Black and I'm proud. And it became Black History Week. And then by 1976, with the work of university students around the country, including and most importantly, the members of Omega Psi Phi Fraternity Incorporated, which Dr. Carter G. Woodson is a member of that, but it was able to be extended from a week to a month, a Black History Month, and then Gerald Ford was the first president in 1976 to proclaim it. But I always want to lay that founding for people to understand that it wasn't after the White House proclaimed it, then we started celebrating. It wasn't even after Dr. Carter G. Woodson set it aside as a week that we started really celebrating. I make the argument that our history was being whispered to children as bedtime stories. It was coming down from the pulpit by pastors. We didn't have to talk about, you know, our contributions to this country because it's already set into the stones of the buildings that, you know, that were built throughout the South. And even the White House was built by the hands of enslaved people. That is solid, and that is the work that we have been doing every single year. In February, we continue the work of our founder, Dr. Carter G. Woodson. He started with choosing a theme to kind of centralize the work. And so every year we choose a theme. Now we choose a theme, you know, sometimes 2 or 3 years in advance. It's always perfect, and what a great moment when it dovetails with what is happening in this country. What an amazing year to have the theme African Americans in labor, because what we're talking about is not just the visible labor of Black folks, which includes, of course, the work of Vice President Kamala Harris, the former work of President Barack Obama. We're talking about teachers. We're talking about professors. We're talking about the work that's done to stock the shelves and drive the trucks and pick up the trash, all of that visible labor. But we're also looking at the invisible labor that Black folks contribute, which is the emotional labor, the raising of our children to be engaged citizens, of taking care of our aging parents. Even the work that we do to get revolutionary rest is a part of the emotional labor that we have in this country. And so 2025 is about celebrating. It's about uplifting, and it's about setting programs, whether that is a protest march in your community, it's a freedom school that you're doing, it's a luncheon that, like the one we're having at the end of February around Black History Month, it's doing
right here in Washington, D.C.
Right in Washington, D.C. We want to make sure that people, you can go to our website, asala.org, but our Black History Month luncheon is February 22nd. It's the largest Black History Month luncheon in the country, as it should be, because it's Asala, but that finding ways to intentionally focus on and center Black history is what we're lifting up. So we tell people, if you're doing things, let us know. We want to add your activity to the wide roster of activities that are happening, not just around the country, but around the world, because Black History Month is celebrated in Ghana. It is celebrated in Ontario. It is celebrated in England. So it has gone beyond the shores of America.
And you gave us a panorama, a big treasure of everything going on through Dr. Woodson's work, into Asala, but on the ground community events and engagements as well. I guess it would be apparent to the listener that you teach and engage on many different levels. One thing I wanted to highlight is you've taught K through 12 level, as well as teaching and educational experiences with adults as well. And that's clearly apparent. Like Dr. Woodson, there's a recognition that in everyday life, our identity, our being, our actual history is important. If you could just highlight further, for instance, 3 years after he got his PhD, the one from Harvard, not the one from the University of Chicago, Dr. Woodson had two PhDs, folks,
yes.
Just to let you know. Chicago had been not only the center of the country, but it had world fairs and world pavilions. And so there was a lot of people, especially as we were entering the 20th century, that would go in and out of Chicago. The event that you mentioned earlier that Dr. Carter Woodson put together, thousands of people attended that event. And not just Black folk, it was the public at large. I also want to just ask you, you know, we around this time each year, we do talk about Dr. Woodson and Black history. He himself supported himself while he was learning, even though you cited that he went to high school late. He was a sharecropper.
Yes.
He was a coal miner in West Virginia. And it's particularly in that coal mining situation, he would meet with older and younger Black men and talk about the news and the current events and how history related to it. He spent some time in the Philippines, I believe.
Yes, he
teaching
did.
As well.
Yes.
So
he was a born teacher, as people would say.
So there are elements here. And the ones you mentioned also too are, you know, that we're people of the continent and of the diaspora. Mm-hmm. We're people who not merely congregate, but wherever we're at, we're engaged with the world. That's called bridging, a long preamble, if I could. So speaking of meeting and convening, also, I guess we both should remind people that ASALA has an annual conference where educators and lay people come together.
Yes, our conference, which is held every year, this year, it is being held in Atlanta, Georgia, which is just such a significant place, given that you have so many HBCUs centralized in the Atlanta, Georgia area. And it will be held from September 24th up until the 28th. Our conference is a little bit different from other academic conferences in that we welcome, invite, and encourage folks to come who want to learn and celebrate and uplift Black history. So we take tours to historic sites. We have luncheons. We have, gatherings down by the fireplace of the hotel to talk about Black history in the same vein that Woodson used to do. I mean, one of the interesting things about Carter G. Woodson, there's so many of them, but one in particular that I want to just uplift is that he believed in the everyday teaching and sharing of information. So it doesn't have to be at a formal gathering, although formal gatherings are important. And that's where, of course, he would go. And that's where he launched Negro History Week and even launching the association. But about just meeting up with people as he did when he worked as a coal miner, as he did when he was a teacher, as he did when he was in the Philippines, just meeting and talking to people and sharing information that we're always supposed to be both teaching and learning at the same time. I want to add to the history that you painted, and I appreciate that. The importance of the Divine Nine, I think that for a number of people in the greater community, if you are not an HBCer, you may not be familiar with the Divine Nine. I think people became very, very familiar with it when our former vice president was running for the presidency. And all of a sudden people said, well, what is AKA? What's Alpha Kappa Alpha? What's the pink and green? Can I wear it? Can I ski wee? Can I show my pinky? And it was like trying to teach people about the work that Divine Nine organizations do. I'm a member of Delta Sigma Theta Sorority Incorporated. Just want to note that. But Dr. Carter G. Woodson, as a member of Omega Psi Phi, to get the message out about Negro History Week, he first turned to his fraternity brothers, Omega Psi Phi. And they created in 1924 Negro History and Literature Week. And then when Woodson said, look, we need to have a wider celebration, that's when he decided that the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History, because that's what it was before, of course, African American became the popularized term. He said, you know, we need to take this task on ourselves and we need to promote and uplift the Negro History, Black History Week celebration. So I think that people have to understand that whenever anything is happening in our community, it is a multi-layered approach because we have all of these platforms that we can tap into, whether it is within our school, within our community. I always uplift the pulpits. I mean, I think about my father-in-law, who was probably one of the great teachers of Black history. He did not have formal education or training in Black history, besides the fact that he had lived experience, but he was a postal service worker. He delivered the mail. And he would go from home to home, gathering not just the formal letters, but gathering community news and sharing it along his route. And so as I talked to my husband, I was like, your father was a Woodsonian, because that's what it means to share the news and understand that no matter where you are, you use whatever platform you have to tell the truth about who we are.
Dr. Whitehead, allow me to reintroduce you. We're talking to Dr. Kay Wise Whitehead. She is the present president of the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, commonly known as ASALA, and also professor of communication in African and African American Studies at Loyola University, Maryland. Our topic on We the People is Black History Month and Beyond. Preserving and teaching about Black life and history, a legacy from Dr. Carter G. Woodson. So much is going on in the world in Dr. Woodson's time and now. And why don't we begin with, what was this social setting? It may be obvious to some of us who look at American history, but what kind of conditions and what kind of reactions and what kind of reception did Dr. Woodson get in initializing this work?
Thank you for that. Because I tell people when in the midst of what is happening now with the regression that's taking place in Washington, D.C. at this moment, this hostile takeover that we're all watching and bearing witness to, that we have been here before. And when I try to paint that picture for people, I'm like, and I'm not saying it was absolutely the same, but as my dad would say, there's really nothing new under the sun when it comes to white supremacy, when it comes to oppression, when it comes to racism. They may have different players. It may be a different way of getting the message out, but the message is the same. There is a deep connection between the way in which Dr. Woodson was taking Black history forward in 1915 specifically. I mean, you're talking about a time that was characterized by what? Long working hours, crowded living conditions, limited access to electricity and running water. Most people were walking or taking streetcars. They weren't jumping in their car and driving somewhere. They weren't, you know, logging onto the internet. And we were also in the midst of what people called the nadir of Black American history. And
categorized by lynchings.
Yes, categorized. And I was going to move into that, to understand, you know, Black folks in 1950, I just want to take it back just a little bit. And I know in the essence of time, I won't take it all the way back to 1619, but if I may take it back a little bit to what was happening in 1865. When December 6, 1865 hit, and you had, of course, the legalization of the 13th Amendment, where two things happened at one time. First, you had, you know, close to 4 million enslaved people, men, women, and children, who received their, quote, legal freedom. But you also have the establishment, we know at that time, of the large mass industrial prison complex. And that's that 13th Amendment, right? So slavery is legal in everyday conditions, but, you know, we're going to keep it in prisons because we got to have somebody that can build up this system, and we can do it that way. So it led to, of course, 1868, which we're all talking about now, because that was the 14th Amendment around civil rights and civil liberties that we know that the current president is talking about when it comes to birthright citizenship. People have to understand that, you know, these things are not new, right? And then you get to 1868 with the 15th Amendment, which is around the protection of voting rights for Black men. We have to be very specific because women didn't get the right to vote till 1920. But Black men, as we know, use the power of the ballot on behalf of their family. I jokingly call it wedding band power, right? So I tell my husband, look, I can't vote, but you need to make sure when you go in there, you're voting for all of us, which we saw almost 600 Black men throughout the South being elected into office, whether it was mayor or sheriff or, you know, comptroller, or even being sent to Washington. That's what we're talking about, Black senators, right? So they were using the power of the ballot. We call that a moment of redemption when you're seeing, you know, universities being founded, HBCUs, when you're seeing the rise in literacy rates around Black people. You'd have the 85-year-old grandmother and the 5-year-old granddaughter all in class together because they're like, look, there's something in these books, as Frederick Douglass said, once you learn to read, you can never be enslaved again because your mind is always going to be free. You saw that moment of redemption. And what history has shown us, whenever there's a moment of redemption in this country for Black people, it is followed by regression. And you see like an intentional rolling back, whether it is through fear, through terror, through lynchings, through mass incarceration, through policies, practices, procedures, and laws, is a rolling back of rights that have been established. Now, I would like to take a little pinpoint here just to note that this is why I think we have a bigger question that we have to answer. If I can just talk 2025 for just a minute, right? We've got to talk about what does it mean to live in a country that tells us we have these inalienable rights, but if rights can be taken away from us and we got to wait for a new president to give them back to us, those aren't rights. Those are conditional privileges, right? Like you just have them for a minute and when somebody else comes along, they take them away. So I want to make a note that that's what regression looks like. And that nadir of Black American history was that period of regression when you saw the rolling back of rights. You can mark it with 1896 and Plessy v. Ferguson, when all of a sudden you're setting up separate but equal conditions. And we know we didn't see that change until 1954. I tell people that is how long, when rights are taken, you have to think about how long does it take to get them reestablished and the fight it takes. 54 gave us Brown v. Board, but that was then with a new Supreme Court. It was a new day. And even then, it took the power of the Supreme Court coupled with the legislative branch for the law, coupled with the president saying, let me send out the National Guard, guns and tanks, right, to make sure that Black kids could go to school. Like it took guards taking Ruby Bridges at the age of 7 into a school. Like that's really what it looks like. So now, when you look at where we are, it was even during that time that Carter G. Woodson said it is more important, even during this time of nadir, even during this period of great regression, we have to focus people on the teaching of our history, how we are tenacious, how we have this form of resilience, how we're able to still have, you know, Black joy, laughter, and we build our families, we love our children, and we build up our communities. And in order for us to know who we are, we have to know where we've come from. You can't figure out how not to fall into the traps of what's happening presently if you don't understand the traps that were set before. Like James Baldwin said, right? Like we live the past. We are our past. We carry our history with us. And so I lay that down because it is through understanding of the work he did in that moment. Like he didn't wait until things were perfect. He didn't wait until Brown, didn't wait until, you know, he said, even in the midst of all of this, it's even more important that we do it, which is why Asala is holding up the banner today. Even in the midst of this incredible regression that we're going through, it is more important that we keep pointing people back to our history because we've been here before and we know what it means to survive moments like this.
We're talking to Dr. K. Wise Whitehead, the 30th person to serve as president of the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, known as ASALA. And our topic here on We the People is Black History Month and Beyond, Preserving and Teaching About Black Life and History. As Dr. Whitehead said, a number of us proclaim Black history to the benefit of others. That is part of the agenda here at WPFW, where we bring you jazz and justice. And part of our proclamation is to inform you of the things that are going on around us in our communities, because we seek to build better communities one broadcast at a time. So in doing that, we'll take a brief break, do some public service announcements, and return to you with more of our focus on Black History Month, Black Life, Black History, and what it means for all of us after this.
Whether it's the courage to tell the truth about displacement, apartheid, and genocide, or our commitment to presenting jazz and all of its extensions, as well as other liberatory musical forms, blues, hip-hop, house, WPFW has been an unwavering partner in the fight for social justice and the preservation of the culture. Now's the time for you to display your courage and commitment to truly independent press by donating during our Winter Pledge Drive from February 9th through the 22nd. It is with your generous financial support that WPFW, this emancipatory educational media outlet, continues to build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Georgetown University professor Maurice Jackson and NEA jazz master Willard Jenkins will interview each other about their books as well as sign them at 7 p.m. on Tuesday, February 11th at the Hill Center at 921 Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast. This is the third session of the series, Our City, Our Music, Our Writers. Details at hillcenterdc.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
And welcome back to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone, right here at WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. We also come to you through various social media platforms. The shows are archived on our website, but they're also available on such places, like iTunes and other media platforms. I join with more than 60 public affairs and news programmers, 100 programmers altogether when you include our mighty crew that brings you the jazz and music part of our station. And as you heard from Brother Kabah, we have been in existence as of this month for 48 years. 48 years of courage and commitment. We have the courage to tell the truth about what's going on in the world, whether it's authoritarianism, displacement, apartheid, or genocide. Our commitment is to present jazz and public affairs through all of their extensions, whether it's news, blues, hip-hop, house, or what have you. WPFW has been your unwavering partner in the fight for social justice and the preservation of life and culture. Be in solidarity with us starting next week and going on to February 22nd by donating any time. Simply go to our website, wpfwfm.org, and you will have the gratitude not only of staff, but all the programmers who are volunteers, unpaid, who donate their time, effort, and care and love for you as we bring you jazz and justice. For that, I'm so grateful, and I thank you in advance. Dr. Whitehead, again, thank you for being with us this morning. We talked about the American society and its conditions that Dr. Woodson worked in. I wanted to also add, in schools throughout the South, Black history and a history curriculum was adopted, but we need to understand that very carefully. What can you tell us about that?
When we talk about the adoption of Black history, we have to look at the places that it was being taught. And this is where the work that we're doing today with the resources that we have, and we have a very extensive library and storehouse of resources, that's what was being provided to teachers. It was the ways in which within the social studies classroom, which was in the grade four, grade five history curricula, which was in the high school government and history courses, that teachers had resources, they had lesson plans, they had materials that they can use in their classroom. We have two major resources that we use. One is our Black History Bulletin, and people talk a lot about the Black History Bulletin. My mom is a big supporter of the Black History Bulletin, because that is actually done for teachers, because you can use that whether you are putting it, you're grabbing resources to use right in your classroom, or you're teaching it in your community center, or you're teaching it at a Saturday church. But the Black History Bulletin, which is one of the big two organizations, big two publications out of Asala that we provide for teachings. It's designed to enhance teaching and learning in the areas of history, and it publishes, generates, and disseminates all peer-reviewed information about African-Americans in U.S. history, but also in the diaspora. And so we tell teachers, if you're looking for a resource, just like what Woodson has always done when we look at the history of the bulletin, we are providing that. And we're making sure that teachers are able to get that and use it in our classrooms. I argue in my research that there are three battlegrounds. And one we know is the ballot, voting booth. We know that's the ballot ground. We know that if you look at the work, whether it's from X to King, you know, the bullet or the ballot, we know that in order to change this country, you have to do it through your voting process. And that is a place that we're getting limited access to. Second, of course, is the white nationalist Christian church and the ways in which they're wrapping policy around religion. And we know that there's a danger with that, particularly people like Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. We need to be very careful about the ways in which we see the encroachment of people's religious beliefs and religious fervor into policies that dictate what we can and cannot do with our body. The third, and a big place that is thinking about, of course, the classroom, is a major area of contestation, that what you teach students and what you put into the hearts and minds of children will dictate how they see the world, how they see themselves, and ultimately how they vote and who they support. And so that's what Woodson was very committed to doing. As a teacher, he was committed to making sure that it doesn't just get taught as a one-off in somebody's classroom, but it gets embedded within the curricula. And that's been a long-standing work to help people understand and help people to really see that Black history is not just a separate teaching that is done. We lift up Black History Month, but we know that we celebrate Black History 365, or as I say, 366, leap year or not, right? We are celebrating what we've done in this country. But in doing that, in helping people to understand, it has to be embedded within the American history curricula. Because if not, they're teaching white American history from March 1st until February 1st, and then they stop. And they're like, okay, we're done with the teaching of American history. Now let's talk about Black people. Right? Like, let's do slavery week one. And by week two, we're in the civil rights movement. Week three, you know, we're talking about Dr. King. And then week four, it's Obama. That people, the kids walk away thinking like, oh my goodness, Harriet Tubman ran away from freedom. And, you know, she ran to meet Dr. King. They got married. They jumped the broom. They had a daughter. And that daughter became Obama's father. Like, they just start collapsing all the history because it's taught like it is something that's off of the American history curriculum. It's like as an addition to rather than a part of. And that has been the work to embed, as far back as Woodson, embedding our teaching into the American history curriculum. Just as a quick aside, we also have our Journal of African American History. So not just the bulletin, which is for teachers and for lay people and anyone who wants to disseminate information in teaching classrooms or in Saturday schools. We also have the Journal of African American History, which is, of course, used more by professors and researchers and students as our peer-reviewed journal of articles about
recording stopped. History.
Dr. Whitehead, allow me to highlight some of the points you made. You know, the nerd that I am, the phrase peer review jumped up at me when you mentioned it two or three times just now. And in regard to creating educational materials on the most popular lay level, if you will, but also fueling the best scholarship possible. So again, peer review means that these things are examined, they're indeed reviewed, they're brought to bear by the work of many people, not just one person having an opinion. That leads me to say that for a long time I was trying to figure out, and I think I just got the quote or the sense of the quote wrong, but Dr. Woodson would often say that Black history or the education of and through Black history is not political. And I think what he meant by that is what you've been saying earlier and repeatedly, and I hope you say it again, our duty is to tell the truth. It's not a matter of feel-good history.
Yeah, People often talk, I just want to just say as an aside, because I hear that a lot, because that's not the quote, not a direct quote from Dr. Carter G. Woodson, that, you know, Black history is not political. What people pull that from is they took a look at his writings, they took a look at his philosophy, they took a look at his sentiments around the importance of studying Black history, not just for its inherent educational value, but also as a tool for political activism. That in understanding Black history, because it does permeate every aspect of our being, whether it's the way in which we show up in the world, the way in which we move, the way in which people respond to us, the conversations that we have, that this can be a key around political activism. The quote that I think that I just like to put on the table is when Carter G. Woodson said, if a race has no history, it has no worthwhile tradition. It becomes a negligible factor in the thought of the world, and it stands in danger of being erased. So I think a lot about that, that we teach the history, not just so that the world could know it, kind of that outward facing form of teaching, but we teach it so that we can know it, and that we have to be able to stand in the understanding of who we are, what we have contributed, and what we are capable of doing. And if people think about what that means and how we can then really use our history and our training today, I think people would be amazed. I think it would help young people to begin to see themselves very differently. It's the same thing that Woodson said, right? And, you know, you got to be able to see yourself in the great continuum of history to understand why your presence at this moment is so important.
Yeah, so it's I have a bad habit of using this expression. We're not presenting floating factoids. You know, we're trying to engage people with a spirit and order of life. In other words, when you learn history, you're also learning how to interpret your sense of being in the world, your own meaning, your own purpose, and then how you're relating to others and what you do with others as well. That being said, we're getting into a little bit of the nitty-gritty of things. You were talking about the willingness of forces that are not so helpful, not seeking to really capitalize on the deep and rich meaning of a multiracial democracy, but will actually erase or distort or misinterpret history. You mentioned the department, or you alluded to the Department of Defense erasing of the Tuskegee Airmen and what women did in the armed forces. Or I heard on this morning's news, agency that does cryptography actually papered over the contributions of Blacks and women in their federal agency. We have a governor of a certain state, I'll say it, Florida, who will distort what enslavement meant and deny all its cruelties and realities. We have another state that denies we have two or three states that have denied outright massacres that are publicly known, established facts. And I guess I would ask maybe the large question that in undertaking education, would Asala or people like yourself be put in a protest position? And what does that mean?
So I think a lot about the ways in which you push back. And I have, like many people have these last couple of weeks, been reading this little book by Timothy Snyder on tyranny, because we have to, in real time, talk about what it means to resist fascism and what does it mean to stand up very honestly, and very clear and sober-minded about the type of America you want to live in, and what does democracy actually mean, and why it is that Hamilton said it was fragile, that you actually have to fight for democracy to remain. I think that there are multiple levels of protest, and I get this question a lot ever since my statement came out on Thursday, kind of introducing myself to the world as the new president of Asala and making the statement that, look, I'm proclaiming that we're doing it based upon the work I'm doing that our founder started, that I'm continuing in that legacy. I tell people that you have to decide how much you can be involved in an outward form of protest, and then what does an inward form of protest look like? So I want to explain that just a minute, if I may. So that this outward form of protest, for example, everyone's saying, look, we're boycotting Target, right? Which is what I call Target. Well, we're not going to go to Target because people have complained that they have moved away from their DEI policies, diversity, equity, and inclusion policies that defined some of the very intentional financial work that Target has been doing with Black business owners within the community, as well as building up certain fundings in the community, scholarships or so. So there was a big, you know, big blow up around it, big dust up. And people are like, I got to join this protest. And I understand that. And then they put out a whole list, you know, not only you know, protest Target, but you got to protest Walmart, you got to protest Amazon. Like it was just, the list just kept going, right? We started thinking about who it was that was intentionally either A, moving away from their diversity, equity, and inclusion work that they have been doing, or even B, even openly being in support of a system that we believe was really detrimental and dangerous for us as Black folks. Okay, that's an outward form of protest. I'm going to join that. I'm going to go down to Washington because a protest happened yesterday at the Department of Treasury. There's a protest happening in front of Elon Musk's residence. There's a protest happening in front of the White House. Okay, I'm going to go down and put my body on the line. Those are outward forms of protest that not everybody can do. If you're working right now, and if you work for like USAID, and you just got a notice yesterday that you're being furloughed, or you have 30 days before you're going to be out of work, or you work for, you know, the CIA, you work, at that point, I'm saying you probably are scrambling, and you're trying to figure out, what do I do financially after this pay period ends? Like, what happens next? You may not have the time, energy, or wherewithal to go out and publicly protest. If you live in an isolated community, some of the small areas in South Carolina where my family members live, you might only have a Walmart in your town. So you're like, I can't boycott the place I get my groceries, my shoes, my batteries, and my medicine from. So like, what do I do, right? Like we have to be realistic about the ways in which we protest. For the people like that, I said, well, there's also an inward form of protest. What are some small daily acts you can do that may not impact what's happening at the White House, but will help you have a little sanity and help you feel like you're contributing and you're standing against the wind of madness? So maybe it's, if you got a shop, I'm just, again, using these as an example, if you got a shop at Target saying, you know what, this is all I have in my community, and I can't order every single product and sit at home and wait for it to be delivered. So if I do go in there, I'm going to intentionally make sure that when I get my eggs, butter, and my batteries, I'm going to make sure I buy one product from this Black-owned company so I can make sure they don't get pulled from the shelves. So I'm going to do that. That's an inward form. I'm going to, as Timothy Sider says in point two of the 20 steps or 20 lessons around, you know, making sure that you are dealing on tyranny and you're protesting, I'm going to find that institution that is doing the hard work, that can hold my anger and frustration, that can be on the front line while I'm at work. And I tell people, I would argue that at least one of those institutions is ASALA. And I'm going to defend that institution with everything I have, not just with my thoughts and my prayers. And as a PK, pastor's kids, I'm like, we want your thoughts and prayers too, but we also want your offerings, right? So I mentioned that I was a PK, which is a pastor's kid. I was taught to pay my tithes. You pay your 10%, you know, above and beyond going to your church. But my dad would say, you know, you pay your tithes, but you also have your offerings. Your offerings are the things that, you know, I'm going to pour into that little program where they're sending kids to camp to the summer. I'm going to pour into that program where I'm there making sure they have food for people who are temporarily experiencing homelessness. It's above and beyond your tithes. I'm telling people, pay your tithes the way you want to pay them to. But that little offering part that you have left, if you're figuring out where do I want to put my money, where so good work can be done in the world, that's the money you use to defend the institution that is doing the work. Because organizations like ASALA can't stand unless our members go, you know, I got $5 and every month I'm going to commit to making sure that $5 goes to ASALA because they can do the work that I can't since I have to go to work every day.
Certainly, I will say unabashedly, that's the way WPFW has existed for 48 years. Mm-hmm. But to swing us back into the larger reach also, something you said that's very important, and it seems, I'll just tie it into a theme or a thread. When we do use our voices, when we do take small and sometimes big actions, it really does make a difference. So like, for instance, the suggestion that when certain major retailers or companies pull back on trying to be inclusive, pull back on being fair to everyone, when they've made efforts, normally, probably through people like us, to recognize there was a particular history of oppression that needs to be corrected, repaired, and healed. So when they decide to walk away from those things and even discontinue stuff, 10 letters could make a difference.
Yeah.
It certainly works with congressional offices. If you're a staffer and they get a collection of letters from 10 people in the same community, that staffer has to tell her boss or his boss that we probably have many people beyond that 10 that have the same sentiments, and it will make a difference. The point that you're emphasizing is not to give up and that every effort matters. And the person making that point is Dr. Kay Wise Whitehead. She is the 30th person to become president, actively serving as of now for the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, known as ASALA. And we're obviously talking about Black History the month and going beyond it. Dr. Whitehead, I'm going to continue to thank you as we're coming to the conclusion of our program. There's so much to be hopeful for, even in this great time of chaos. And actions do make a difference. You talked about many different efforts. What is the level of awareness that we should have of one another? Every strategy, we need really a plural, diverse way of engaging stuff, not just for battle, but for preserving, for sustaining, for thriving.
I'm so glad you said that, because I was hoping that I would have an opportunity. And so I'm glad in this last little bit of time that I can quickly outline what my platform is as the president of ASALA. So what I have launched is Project ASALA 2025. We are all familiar with Project 2025. And if you're not, I would urge all listeners to go just take a quick glance. You actually can either read Project 2025 online, or you can actually just look at what's happening in Washington. Project 2025 is alive and well and being implemented. We're doing Project ASALA 2025, which has three quick layers. One is to preserve Black history. And that's that notion of finding that institution you believe in and you defend it. We want people to help us defend ASALA, to make sure that our history is being uplifted and celebrated, and that we at ASALA can continue to do the work. That's that the offerings that I've been talking about. Second is to promote Black history. I tell people that promoting Black history is, you have to become an ambassador of our history. It's nothing to do with your race or ethnicity. You need to learn Black history, and you need to help us teach Black history. Do your Saturday school. Join with us on the Freedom School Initiative. You know, I'm not saying you have to read every single book about Black history. Choose one. Choose one.
Well, the Miseducation of the Negro. 110 great, years ago, Dr. Woodson.
That's a great place to start.
wrote a book that helps us think through stuff today.
Yes. I mean, Get the Miseducation of the Negro. It is a great place to start. Don't just do an op-ed. Don't do a podcast. Get the history and learn the history. And third, of course, once you have preserved Black history and promoted Black history, you got to protect Black history. I tell people that I use this quick example, if I may. My sister actually went live on Facebook the other night, accidentally. She was like doing her hair and she clicked the live button. And I called her and said, "Hey sister, you're live on Facebook. Your hair's not done. You're like talking out loud, you're singing." And she's like, "Oh my goodness." But she had 59 people just watching her doing her hair and singing. I said, "You know, you had 59 people watching by mistake. Imagine if you were intentional." I tell people, use every platform you have to tell the truth about who we are. It might just be one person listening. It might be 59. It might be 59,000. Use the platform you have to tell the truth about who we are. And to do that, you have to learn the history. You have to know the history. And you have to stand with the institutions that are doing the work, like ASALA.
Well, Dr. Whitehead, again, thank you. We've been talking to Carsonia K. Wise Whitehead, president of the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, known as ASALA, A-S-A-L-H. And if you add a .org behind that, you'll find out many of the things we were talking about in this hour. My thanks to the News and Public Affairs Department departments of WPFW, and to my engineer, Mike Nasella. Later on today, 5 minutes before the hour, the news will come to you. But immediately following this program, don't forget the blues. During the weekday, every noontime hour, we bring you an hour of blues. Really done very well. Hitting the one. Clarence the Blues Man Turner does that on Wednesdays. 1 o'clock, Africa Now with host Moesa Mutale. Affairs of African descended people, not only on the continent, but throughout the diaspora, that affect all of us. All that and more right here at WPFW. It only happens because we have a relationship with you, the listener. We're entirely listener supported, and we thank you for that. I thank you for that. Be well, and hopefully we'll meet again on the radio. Take good care.
Tell the truth about displacement, apartheid, and genocide, or our commitment to presenting jazz and all of its extensions, as well as other liberatory musical forms. Blues, hip-hop, house, WPFW has been an unwavering partner in the fight for social justice and the preservation of the culture. Now's the time for you to display your courage and commitment to truly independent press by donating during our winter pledge drive from February 9th through the 22nd. It is with your generous financial support that WPFW, this emancipatory educational media outlet, continues to build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Georgetown University professor Maurice Jackson and NEA jazz master Willard Jenkins will interview each other about their books as well as sign them at 7 p.m. on Tuesday, February 11th at the Hill Center at 921 Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast. This is the third session of the series, Our City, Our Music, Our Writers. Details at hillcenterdc.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Wondering how to get WPFW swag in your life? Items that say, I support jazz and justice without saying a word. We've got you covered. Details and browsing at WPFWFM.org. Again, that's WPFWFM.org.
Ah, yeah. Come on, come on, come on.
To the east, my brother, to the east.
To the east, my brother, to the east. Come on.
To the east, my brother, to the east.
To the east, my brother, to the east. Yeah.
To the east, my brother, to the east.
To the east, my brother, to the east. My brother, to the east.
Education, art, health, music, politics, and all things community.
Yes.
Join me, Ambrose Lane Jr., as we uncover the issues of D.C. communities east of the river on To the East, Mondays at 5 p.m. right here on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW 89.3 FM.
Hi, this is Jim Byers, host of the Latin Flavor Classic Edition. Support from listeners like you are the tools that have built WPFW over nearly five decades. We provide news, music worth listening to, and in-depth conversations about your community and the world. One of the many ways that you could contribute is to donate a vehicle that you no longer need, running or not. It can do wonders for WPFW, so donate it for a tax break for 2024. Go to WPFWFM.org or call 1-866-WPFW-CAR. That's 1-866-973-9227 for more information. Help WPFW continue building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, asking you to support WPFW. We ask you, please, to go to the website and make a pledge, maybe $47 or $470 if you can, or $47 a month, to WPFW.org. Hey, if you want to get dinner and a show in New York, if you want to bring a guest with you, maybe your partner or a daughter or son, a friend you want to meet up with in New York, watch the broadcast of Democracy Now! Live, 8 in the morning, sit on the set as we broadcast on over 1,000 stations, and then I get to personally host you for a meal, and we will toast WPFW, and it is an amazing time. We call it dinner and a show, you and your special guest. That's a $2,000 tax-deductible charitable contribution that goes directly to WPFW. Go online at WPFW.org. And by the way, you don't have to know when you can come to New York, where Democracy Now! Is based. Just make that call or go online at WPFW.org, make the pledge, and then we'll get in touch with you and work out the details.